Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. Thanks a lot to my friends at Sastrify for sponsoring this episode. A lot of CTOs I know are responsible for procurement of software as a service by accident and never have the time and energy to work on optimizing their costs. For example, at my company OMR, we have a lot of tools. G Suite, Adobe Creative Cloud, New Relic, and many, many more. Sastrify helps companies like ours to optimize the costs and negotiate with suppliers of such software. In our case, they helped us to save around 20K per year, which is a lot if you look at our company size of around 150 people. It is a simple and hassle-free process we went through, and I can just recommend anyone listening to do the same. They actually promised to save more money than they cost. They are already working with a lot of AlphaList members, such as Runtastic, Westwing, or Emma. To get started using their services, please visit sastrify.com/alphalist. Just check the show notes to get the link. You'll get a 50% discount for the first 3 months in addition. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. The headline for this episode is remote one-on-one, a topic I'd like to touch for a while. And today I'm very proud to have Eric Johnson as my guest. Eric is the CTO of GitLab, a tool every listener here potentially knows. They collected almost $500 million in funding. That is quite impressive. And they are known to be one of the most advanced remote work companies in the world. Eric, anything to add here about yourself?
That's a pretty good intro. The only other things I would add to that are, I'm a startup person, so GitLab is my fifth startup. So I'm happy to talk about, starting at small companies and growing them with varying degrees of success. I would say, just to contextualize some of my answers, there are, many types of CTOs. It's maybe the most varied C-level position. And so, I've worked with CTOs who are the lead sales engineer, and their role is very outward facing. I've worked with CTOs who are a PhD in some very obscure field and do nothing but pure R&D outside of product development and engineering. Or some like myself are kind of like the super VP of engineering. And so if that's helpful to your audience, I would say that's that latter type is the kind of type of CTO I am. So I manage 560 people directly or indirectly. And that's kind of the core of my strength is I came up through the sort of VP of engineering ranks. But obviously I try to do as much outward facing stuff as is helpful to the company, including something like this. In terms of pure R&D, we do have a little department we started called incubation engineering. And so we are doing some of that kind of far future type work, far future for GitLab, as well. So I'm kind of branching out into those other areas of CTO. So I'm sure there's people in your listeners who are one or many types. And I think understanding that where I come from is, managing a large group of people doing product development will help people understand where I'm coming from and hopefully whether or not they should listen to me.
And how did you get into that role? How did you slip into it? Like typically there's a certain nerd path for every CTO and VP engineering I talk to. What is yours?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely non-traditional. So like a lot of people you probably talk to, I was definitely the tinker as a kid, taking things apart in my parents' home, failing to put them back together and ruining stuff. Went into math and sciences. Actually started my college career in electrical engineering. So it was a highly technical field, but in retrospect, I wanted to do things. The way my mind thinks is very, very visual, very, spatial. And I wanted to do things like robotics and whatnot. I ended up in a program that was doing mostly abstract math and I could do the math, but I didn't find it intrinsically rewarding. So I went to my first day of classes, my sophomore year after doing the entry level stuff and just said, I just don't this doesn't make me happy doing it every day. I want to do something else. So I walked in my advisor's office and I had two interests at that time. One was computer science. In retrospect, it would have been a much more direct path to if I just chosen that. But instead, my needle kind of went to the other end of the spectrum, being sort of burned out on EE. And philosophy was one of my personal interests. And so I happened to be at a school that had a fantastic philosophy program. And I ended up there. And in retrospect, that's sort of fortuitous. When you look at engineering ranks, engineering management ranks as startups, you see a lot of history majors, literature majors, some philosophy. Like there's something about, like, I think of philosophy as systems thinking, and it's not all that different from technological thinking in many ways. There are systems, there are inputs, there are outputs. And so it does lend itself to engineering management strategy. But also obviously there's a lot of reading, writing, communication, and that turns out to be very valuable in the managerial realm. So it worked out, but it's not the path I would recommend to people. For me, I kept kind of programming on the side. I kept that computer science interest. I was a hobbyist programmer, went through the philosophy program, and then ultimately decided, you know, my professors at the time were the type of people that would, you know, take a summer off and go learn Portuguese for fun. You know, they just had that talent for foreign languages, and they would speak ancient Greek, Latin, German, French, and, you know, a couple other languages just for fun. And that wasn't me. I don't really have that mind for music or foreign languages. And so I would have struggled to go further and like get a PhD and teach, which is kind of like the only thing you can do if you go far enough down the philosophy ranks. So I graduated, kind of wandered for a little while, was working jobs I hated and programming every night, living at my parents' house. And then it clicked at one point. It's like, maybe this is the thing that I should do. So I scrapped together a personal portfolio of projects I was working on, started applying and got my first job at a technology company that also turned out to be a startup. So it was a small kind of entrepreneurial company. They took a chance on me and sort of the rest is history from there. So it all worked out, but I definitely wouldn't recommend to young people of like, oh yeah, that's the path you should take. It's gonna end up where I did. I feel very fortunate that I found my way and that the technology industry is at a point where, you know, if you can do, you can get the job. It's not about credentials and it's not about specific schools or degrees at this point.
And anything that sticked from your studies? I mean, writing, for example, as a skill that is quite popular amongst CTOs?
Yeah. I mean, I quote philosophers all the time. I try to hold back on that, but I draw a surprising amount of my philosophy education into the management responsibilities for sure. We can get into how GitLab is a remote company, but certainly our documentation culture is a big part of that. And so, asynchronous communication, reading, writing is really important. And I got sort of trained up on, you know, how to be clear, also concise. You know, it should be everything the person needs to know in a format that they can consume and nothing that they don't need to know. And I think sometimes people that love writing can go into that territory of lots of extraneous information. So knowing how to pare it down and make it effective is really important.
Yeah, I recently had Tim O'Reilly here in the podcast, and he's kind of a person that knows a lot about writing and how to express yourself and how to structure things. And I think this is really like a secret ingredient for a lot of companies already, right? And I think Amazon kind of teaches that really a lot in the last years, that you start with a PR potentially instead of starting with a ticket. And I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think, you know, my wife is, her field is psychology. She's a PhD. So she, her training had a lot to do with writing, and it is highly structured. Same with lawyers. The legal documents are highly structured language. And when you start to understand that structure and what works and what doesn't, you start to see similarities between code, honestly. And if you're good at picking up on those patterns, you know, it lends itself towards programming. Sometimes I talk to the lawyers at GitLab or people are doing other things, and I think, gosh, in another life, you may have gone down the computer science route and been a fantastic programmer.
I think one thing where you can easily discover that you're also into structuring yourself and writing is your README. So if I Google your name, or if the listeners Google your name, then they'll find a README on yourself. What is the idea behind that?
Yeah, I forget who started the trend, but if you Google engineering readmes, you'll see like the initial version of it and people blogging about it. And it's really a way for new employees or my reports or people engineering to be able to go and learn about me, read async, and have an idea of like what are my strengths and what are my weaknesses, or if they're interacting with me, how can they be presenting information to me in a way that I find understandable and I can consume it. But it's not about having a big title or how to manage up. We encourage anybody at GitLab to create a README. So there's actually a whole directory. Mine is just one amongst many, and lots of different people at every, at junior levels, mid levels, so to speak, have created READMEs. And it's just a handy way to, you meet someone or you hire someone and say, hey, here's a little bit about me. And hopefully it changes and evolves with time, because obviously we're, especially at an entrepreneurial startup, you're growing and changing and learning, as you go. So it's important to keep it up to date.
So Jason Warner, the CTO of GitHub, actually came up with a sentence, introspection is the ultimate superpower. And I think that kind of spins into the same direction, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. To quote philosophers, I think Sophocles said the unexamined life is not worth living, right? So I would think the way I would frame that though is like, so as opposed to introspection, I think like the ability to correctly self-assess, if I were to like kind of define it more precisely, that's what's really, really important. And, moving into my wife's field, there's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where they basically develop you could take any objective measure of your knowledge or performance in a field. It could be plumbing, it could be engineering, whatever. And you have a test that assesses for it. And then you have people take that test. And then you also ask them, how do you think you did on that test, as a separate data point? And it turns out there's an inverse correlation between how well people think they did and how they actually did on it. And then, when you get to, people that are worldwide experts in a field, it turns out they actually slightly underestimate their knowledge, which means like top scientists or whomever, they are skeptical of their own knowledge. And so how well you can accurately self-assess actually correlates with how effective you are at a given field. And the higher your confidence is that you know something, you're an expert in something, is actually an indication that you probably aren't. And it sort of makes sense. There's probably a variety of reasons why, but if you feel like you've learned everything there is to learn, there's little motivation to learn new things. And I think people that are the top in their field are always learning and always innovating and trying things and exposing themselves to new information.
So how much does your README then correlate with your real personality?
it's meant to, but various people have found it helpful. I read other people's READMEs. It's bidirectional. I hope there's a high degree of correlation. I mean, how I endeavor to work is there shouldn't be two Erics. It shouldn't feel like there's a work Eric that's highly polished or political or something like that. Then there's a personal Eric where I like to wear Hawaiian shirts and drink beer or something like that. It's like, no, who I am, in order to make me happy, I want to bring my full authentic self to work. Obviously there are, if you're talking to a customer or something like that, you have to have a certain degree of polish and whatnot. But for the most part, it should be one-to-one overlap.
Okay. I think one important aspect from your README is the sentence, he believes in the servant leadership model and staying cool under pressure. Can you tell us about both?
Yeah. So the servant leader model is well known. The way I think about it is you have separation of concerns or division of labor within an engineering organization. Someone might be focused more on back end versus front end versus test automation. And you are an expert in that area, but it also comes with the obligation to sort of lend those skills to your teammates to make the whole team more effective and make them more effective. And then management as a skill, I view as just another sort of thing that you can specialize in. But I think because you've got a organizational structure that looks like a pyramid, I think some managers can take that too far. Some people can sort of misinterpret that managers are above everybody else. And I don't think that's the case. I think managers have a separate specialty, just like front end versus back end. And it also comes with an obligation or imperative to use those skills to make everybody else more effective, make the team more effective. So I usually tell people, to the extent there's this pyramid or this hierarchy, it's really there for the benefit of things like hiring and communication, because it's an efficient structure in which to arrange people in that regard. But it's not about I'm more valuable than someone else because I'm higher in the org chart. And if you Google GitLab org chart, you can see we've got it public in our handbook. And one of the things I love about it, maybe accidental, is it's actually oriented sideways. And so you don't necessarily see bigger titles at the top. They're at the left, which is has maybe it's a little bit easier to not misinterpret as correlated with value.
Okay.
So that's servant leadership. I will say I somewhat recently interviewed a candidate who is an engineering management candidate, and they talked about something called situational leadership. And so I've been thinking about that. I'm like, that's really interesting. That might actually be a better formulation of where I'm at now. I think servant leader is definitely my default. When engineers go into their first management role, I definitely tell them like, hey, you know, don't focus on, especially if you're inheriting your former peers' reports, don't focus on being the manager, just focus on being a servant leader. That's the best way to take over a team. But at this point in my career, having done it for a long time, I definitely see myself shifting into different gears depending on the situation. And so there may be some people you talk to and say, oh, Eric's not a servant leader. He's a micromanager or something like that. It's like, well, that's probably a situation where we're not getting the results that we need and I'm becoming more involved or something like that. But I think you have to develop that ability to assess the situation and the different styles that you can apply over time. And that comes when you've been doing this for a relatively long time. Although I want to be cautious, I don't want to say it's about years served. It's much more about distance travel. There are people that learn things that maybe take most people 20 years of management experience and they do it in 3 because they were just at the right company at the right time, or they were going through explosive growth or something like that. So it's not about years of experience. It's more about what you've been sort of exposed to.
And staying cool under pressure.
Yeah, thanks for the prompt on that one. So this one's interesting. I think I say in the readme, like, yeah, I endeavor to be cool under pressure. And sometimes that can actually, like, the readme is in part about side effects or you know, it's not about being perfect. It's like, hey, this is how this might be misinterpreted. Sometimes people might look at you, and if you're not getting hot, if you're not getting agitated, if you're not starting to yell, some people might look at that as like, oh, well, he doesn't care. He's not passionate. And that's not the case. I think if you're interested in like how to be cool under pressure, I think a lot of it comes from, you know, what I just mentioned, being, you know, exposing yourself to lots of different situations, having the time to experiment and try things and see what works. So when you recognize those same patterns, you kind of have a toolbox of techniques you can apply and that works. And I think coolness under pressure kind of comes over time. However, there's an other element to me personally that may or may not apply to people like that first example does. So like growing up, I was that sort of like really overly anxious kid that would just stay up all night with insomnia worrying about global warming or something like that. You know, like I didn't have enough of a filter to know like what to care about versus what not to care about. And I kind of burned out myself just worrying. And so I was the opposite of cool under pressure. I was like highly reactive to things. And I had to go through a period of time, like grade school, middle school, where I just had to kind of, first I became somewhat detached and I stopped caring about school and whatnot. And then I had to kind of find my way back to center. So I almost feel like I had to be down-regulated to develop that coolness under pressure. But so part of it was that kind of like I deliberately changed my personality early in my life because I didn't feel happy or healthy. And so like the way I think about that is, you know, you get information, we're thinking using our frontal lobe. That's where the pattern detection is happening. That's where you're working through problems. And when you encounter something you can't understand, that's when you trigger, you know, an emotional reaction or something like that. And I think in the extreme sense, like there's a part of the brain, I believe, called the amygdala, and it's like a switch. If you trigger it, it goes right to your lower brain. And that's like your fight or flight response. And it's not, I don't mean to discount emotions, and not everything is that sort of acute, but you know, the goal is to not trigger that sort of system and keep everything up in the frontal lobe. So for me, I had to kind of learn to blunt my initial kind of overreaction to things to stay up in that frontal lobe. And then with the experience, I think the different techniques and ways I could respond to situations kind of came online. And now at this point in my career, I kind of feel like there's very few things that I haven't seen before. And I usually know at least something that has worked in the past. And then you just try to be sensitive to like, well, this is a different company or this is a slightly different situation. So let's just not repeat patterns. Let's really think about, is this the solution for the matter at hand at the current time?
Do you have any technique or anything you can recommend to others to maybe just ignore stuff when it's not really pressing? I mean, waking up at night, thinking about some technical stuff or leadership issues, what do you do?
I've heard it said by, I learned about the amygdala thing from a neuroscientist that came to speak at my previous company. And they said like, if in their setting, like a clinical setting, if someone is triggered like that, really the only thing you can do to get them out of that is you have to let time pass and you can accelerate a little bit by just getting them to talk. If you're getting someone to talk through that, if they've been sort of triggered or whatever term you want to use, and you get them to kind of verbalize, it will kind of like blunt that initial response, you know, get them back up into sort of frontal lobe thinking. So that's one thing. So if you find yourself responding like that, you think like, oh, I need to start talking about what I'm experiencing, what I'm feeling, and that will help you come out of it. But it does take time to pass. I mean, you've triggered cortisol and hormones, and there's a biological element to this. It can't happen instantaneously. It's not all pure thought.
So that's shouting. Yeah.
Calm, cool, collected verbalization, I guess, would be the middle way. So that's one thing that comes to mind that might help people.
Okay. Maybe like a brief history of GitLab and talking about a bit more about GitLab. How did you guys become like a real challenger of GitHub? I mean, I think you started off as an open source, like purely open source Rails, very open tool that people use because they didn't want to pay for GitHub. How did that change?
Yeah, that's definitely one of our main differentiators. When I think about what draws people to GitLab, you know, developers tend to love open source. They love using open source, contributing to it. Some of us get the chance to actually initiate a project, and that's an opportunity to, you know, build a community around something that you've built, which is exciting to a lot of people. And then we spend all day at work in these closed source tools, and that just feels sort of inconsistent in some way. So GitLab being an open source DevSecOps platform is part of, I think, the initial impetus, but also it's just as true today. And we take being the open core shepherd of the project really seriously as a company. So that's one element. Another big element is there's a story. It predates my time, but one of our engineers, Camille, got frustrated at one point because he was working on GitLab CI, which was a separate project. And he's like, I don't want to do all that authentication stuff again. I don't want to do all that permission stuff again. Why don't we roll CI into GitLab source control? And the initial reaction got that internally was like, no, that would be a bad idea. It would be so big. The user experience would be weird. And he's like, okay. And he thought about it more and he came back and posed it again and got denied again. And so there's actually something in our handbook called disagree and commit and disagree again. And Camille, what he did was a great example of this. So he advocated that CI be bundled into GitLab. And that really initiated what has become what we call our single application strategy. And so the idea is you don't need to create a DevSecOps tool chain out of all of these different products. You can have it in a single application. We, meaning the development community, understands enough about what a good DevOps tool chain is, that it's ripe for some consolidation. And then when you get our benefits, like one data store, one API, one consistent user experience, and I think it feels substantially better than bridging your daily experience or your tool chain across all these separate applications that integrate fairly well with one another. So that's a big one. And then another thing I would say that's maybe subtle, but really significant is the pace at which we're a very velocity focused company, and the pace at which GitLab moves forward is remarkable. Like iteration is one of our core values. And that has to do with just shipping a ton of small incremental value. But the net effect of that you see, if you're following our monthly self-managed release post, is pretty dramatic. And so customers come to us, say like, we're comfortable using GitLab or buying GitLab, not even based on what it is today, but also what we know is going to be 6 months or a year down the line, because it moves that fast. And so the pace at which we're innovating, I think, is a big differentiator to people.
And long term, will it be like a development platform covering all the needs of a developer, or what will it be?
Yeah, that's very much the vision. I mean, you can set up a Kubernetes cluster from within GitLab. You can test your code. You can run security scans on that code. You can deploy. You can get metrics from how that deploy went in your production environment. And you know, if you're doing a blue-green deploy or something like that, you can say, oh, there's a problem, roll back. And you can do that all from within GitLab as you know, sort of the single pane of glass, so to speak. So that's the vision. And then there's also there's features in there for other personas, like product managers work very closely with engineering. And so there's planning features, there's portfolio management features. You can see roadmaps and Gantt charts and things like that. There are features in there for designers that work very closely with engineers, taking part in those product development workflows, discussing their assets, collaborating with product managers as well. And so we're expanding the breadth of what GitLab does, including into sort of engineering adjacent specialties.
Okay. And does it cover then a marketplace as well, or is a marketplace not a piece in your puzzle?
Wait, say more about what you mean by marketplace.
Well, if you look at GitHub, then it has a marketplace where, let's say you're doing exception monitoring, you can publish your tool. You can sell your tool. Actually, you can sell it on a marketplace for developers that might be attracted to it.
Yeah, I think that our answer to that would be, you know, open source. You know, if you want things, go to the open source community and integrate those things into how you've configured GitLab or into your code base.
Okay. And was it due to the fact that you developed a large open source code base that you actually got in touch with your community and then hired maybe a few ones of those and became a fully remote company, or how did it work out?
Yeah, so it's kind of two separate things in there. One is like how we interact with our community, and then separately how we became a remote company. So yeah, we do pay attention to to answer the community question. We pay close attention to the contributions that we're getting. The amount of people contributing to GitLab is important to us. We've got a team in our marketing department that does evangelism and outreach. We've got people engineering focused on doing what we call MR coaching. So if someone contributes, they have a GitLab team member that's a maintainer of the project, reviewing their code, doing so in a timely fashion, helping to teach and educate about how something, if something needs to change, why and how to do that. So that's an easy experience for people to contribute to GitLab. And then, yes, we have like a lot of the early employees, the ones that were here when I started about 4 years ago, we hired them from the GitLab community. And so to the extent we care about, well, how many people internal are contributing to GitLab, internal to the GitLab Inc. meaning, versus external, we hurt ourselves when we bring people external, internal to the company. But hey, it's given a lot of people the opportunity to take what was a passion project for them or a hobby and get to do it full-time for work. So we want to keep growing that external community, because that's really meaningful to us. And then the second thing you mentioned was, is that related to us becoming a remote company? That was before my time, but my understanding is not really. The interesting bit is that it wasn't particularly intentional to be an all remote company. So the early folks like DZ, who created the open source project, Sid, our founder and CEO, Marin, one of our first employees, they got started. They were sort of just spread out all over Europe. They applied to Y Combinator and got in, and a bunch of people came over to the West Coast of the US to go through the program there. And then started an office and started hiring, you know, like our first salesperson, I think it was Hayden, and other people. And there was a whole kind of like co-working space almost. And then people just kind of stopped showing up. Like they'd come in for the first couple of days. And then, you know, because they were already collaborating with people in Europe and other time zones, they realized like, oh, well, you know, I have an early meeting, I'll just do it from home. And that worked just fine for everybody. And so we kept, from what I understand, before my time, we kept sort of, you know, having offices and then seeing them go underutilized. And then eventually was like, hey, maybe we could really lean into this thing and be very intentional about it. And so I think it started more of as an accident. But once we detected that pattern, it was like, all right, like, what do we do to do this really well? We don't want people who weren't in the, even if you don't have an office, there's typically a cluster of people, especially leaders. You don't want that to become a sort of form of favoritism. So they wanted to really make sure that people in other time zones and other countries had a good experience. And so you'll see a lot of content in our handbook around asynchronous work and collaboration. And that's really where that comes from, is that's how GitLab conquers the time zone challenge. And the ideal is, you know, everything's written down. We can talk about our documentation culture. And someone should be able to wake up in whatever time zone they're in. Or we've even got people in the same time zones, and one likes to work early and one likes to work late. That's okay too. You should be able to kind of see in artifact form, you know, what was done, what the current state of something is, be able to pick it up if it's a work item, make progress on it, and then, you know, document where you left off, and you go to bed or you go do things with your family or have a weekend, and someone else picks it up and moves it forward. And I would say when I started, there was actually sort of an antipathy towards meetings where there was resistance to get on something like a Zoom call. Since then, I think we've developed a more balanced approach, which is we say asynchronous is kind of our default, and that's the first thing that we do. But now we're pretty good about detecting when it stops working. And then we sort of fall back to more relatively expensive forms of communication, like a Zoom call, or every once in a while we do fly to the same place and meet in person, like an employee conference or, you know, smaller, more sales marketing focused events and whatnot. Now it feels like effective because, you know, to underscore an issue with async, like everybody knows sarcasm doesn't work over email, right? And so those same types of things happen whether you're communicating over email or writing things down in GitLab issues. We run the whole company on an instance of GitLab. When miscommunication is happening, we just need to be mindful about saying, okay, clearly we're talking past one another. Let's hop on a Zoom and see if we can get on the same page in 15 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it takes. And then try to switch back to a more asynchronous form of work.
Okay. So you don't have synchronous stand-ups or anything?
We kind of leave aspects like that up to individual managers. So you can do a stand-up, but you can do it with a Slack bot and you can let it be async. You say, like, you know, give your update anytime in this 24-hour period and everybody read the Slack channel. And that works fairly well. If you are blocked, which is one of the important functions of a stand-up, you know, just reach out proactively to the manager and they can work on blocking you. There are some teams that are kind of aligned in time zones, usually due to accident. And if they want to do a synchronous stand-up, they can do it. What we say is, you know, that cannot become a reason at some point down the future to not hire someone in Australia, if you're located in Europe or wherever it is, because it's inconvenient. The only exception to that are teams where we have to sort of run a follow the sun model, meaning like SREs or our support staff, support is part of engineering at GitLab. There, we need people awake and working when customers are awake and working, or we need to cover a 24-hour time span in the day. And so we have to be deliberate about where we hire. But again, we have someone in Central Russia who I think likes to sleep in, and so they work Europe time, and that's okay too, as long as we know we're covered from a time zone perspective.
And did you ever hear the sentence, help, I haven't seen anyone for days. I'm lost here. I need to see someone. I need to talk to someone.
No, we do have, I haven't heard that. I'm sure it's happened. I think when I joined, the company was about 200 people. I was the 99th person in engineering. And at that time, I would say we were a little bit light in the Asia Pacific region. So like Japan, Australia, Korea, Thailand, India to some extent. I think some people did have that experience of like they're awake and working and there's just only a handful of people and Slack feels like the rest of the company is asleep. And that was probably true. Now we're 1400 or 1500 employees. And so that allowed us to get to what I would call sort of critical mass in that region. And I think it's a lot more comfortable for those folks. So we were lucky. We had the sort of mandate to grow fast, because we have a certain amount of funding, a certain business opportunity in front of us. If you were smaller, if you didn't have the sort of number of heads in your hiring plan to do that, you might have to think about you know, targeting specific locations or something like that, so people didn't have a bad experience. But some people are perfectly fine working mostly async, and they have maybe a low need for social interaction, or maybe they're getting what they needed more from their personal life. So everybody's different, and that's okay. We do have a variety of mechanisms at GitLab that are meant to sort of supplement that, you know, water cooler that, so to speak, that in-person offices have, or the lunchroom table or whatnot. So like one of our little ceremonies is, you know, called coffee breaks. And so when new employees join, they're encouraged to schedule 10 coffee breaks, you know, random people all over the country, company, people in different functions. So you have a chance to learn about what does marketing do? What does engineering do? What does sales do? And there's no agenda. You know, you're drinking coffee or tea and you're just getting to know someone. And so that's one of the ways we supplement the kind of natural socialization that happens when you're in the same physical space.
But you can also have such things through like a Slack bot that gets people in touch with each other, right? Randomly or something like that. Is that something you do?
I don't think it exists today, but I think at some point there was some form of roulette, or there might be a Slack channel that I'm just not in where there's some kind of roulette and people are kind of randomly assigned people to do coffee breaks. I do want to say that does exist, or did exist at one point. And employees, they self-organize and do stuff all the time, which is great. These techniques and what we try shouldn't all come from management. Employees surprise us all the time with innovative things they've tried, and some of them work. And when it works, we, you know, roll it out. We make it available to other people or standardize on it.
Okay. And you seem to run on Slack a lot, or are you also an email company, or do you have other channels as well?
We are primarily a GitLab company. So we try to do everything in issues. And that's, you know, you think of like, oh, I found a bug, I file an issue. That's absolutely true. However, if marketing is going to run a campaign, they start an issue and they have a backlog. So every function of the company runs on an instance of GitLab, and we use issues and boards. Our handbook, you can think of it as documentation. I think a more accurate way to think of it is actually as a database that contains the current state of the company. And it's very, very active. So, you know, documentation we tend to think of as, well, it's written in stone. It's documented for eternity or something like that. This is the most active repo I've ever been a part of. And it's changing. There's thousands of MRs going into it daily. And so the merge request is a really important artifact for us. So if you think of like, what do managers do? Managers change the state of their company. But in most companies, it's kind of like this ethereal thing that nobody can really grasp. In our case, it's written down in a static site generator, and it's published to the whole world. And if someone wants to know what the expense policy is or what the definition of done is for an engineering code review, they can go read what it is. And if someone has decided to change a policy or something like that, but not open up the handbook, it's not real. That's not the policy. The policy is what's in the handbook. And what's cool about that is, this sort of open-ended ethereal process I talked about managers, especially changing the state of their company. For us, it happens in a very direct and understandable way. I want to change a policy. I go find the page in the handbook that describes it. I open up a merge request. I make my changes, and then people can see the diff. This is exactly what's been added, removed, or changed to a policy, and they can comment on it. They can suggest it. They can author their own stuff. It doesn't have to necessarily emanate from management. And then when it merges, it gets deployed, and the documentation is up to date, and everybody knows that's the new policy. That's what we're going to follow. So we've actually formalized something that I now understand about my previous roles and previous companies always existed and always was true, but we've made it a very real and rigorous process to, I think, everybody's benefit without adding a lot of, you know, red tape and the bad things that come with that.
Yeah, much cooler to do that on GitLab instead of on a wiki, right? And Confluence.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, wikis are fine. It's difficult to do things like multi-page edits, which many of our changes are. And you don't necessarily have all those sort of like editing controls and things like that. Like it's with doing it on GitLab, you know, we have review apps. So if I do an MR, you can actually see a version of the handbook at a non-production URL, and you can see the whole rendered page there. And if you don't like it, or if we change it, fine. We haven't changed it in production, of course, because it's all Git based. You have an audit trail, and we know exactly who changed what when, and can revert and all that stuff. So.
Yeah, it's nice. And if you have a few engineers in your teams, then most of them will like Markdown, right? So
Yeah, I mean, Markdown, the workflow is a direct hit for what engineers do all day. So they take to it really easily. It is, I think, a little bit of a heavier lift to have the other personas that make up our company, marketing, sales, and people ops, to get comfortable writing Markdown using this flow. But it's a great chance for them to be hands-on with their company's product. And a lot of them have worked at other places where they didn't get a chance to use the product. They had to sell it, but they weren't actually using it. They didn't need to use it. And in our case, we do a good job eating our own dog food, because everybody at GitLab needs to be a essentially all day, every day user of the product. And so we have a high degree of understanding and empathy of what our users and what our customers go through. And so if people don't necessarily come with that kind of prior technical experience using the workflows I mentioned, they, you know, they get it and they're incentivized by learning their company's own product and using it.
This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.
So, thanks a lot. Coming back, or stepping a step back to remote working. So what would you say are the three most important things you have to do if you want to be a successful remote first company?
Just three.
Or five.
I'll try to prioritize. I do think that you know, I mentioned, like, it's our documentation culture and working asynchronous is how we sort of conquer that time zone challenge. When we interview, especially managers who are coming from other companies, we ask them, like, well, how do you work with teams in, you know, if they're Europe based, how do you work with teams in India or in Australia or whatever the time zones are they're bridging? And they usually say, oh, well, it's just on me, and I just do phone calls on the weekend and in my evening time and whatnot. And, like, that's not sort of our approach. Some remote companies have kind of constrained the problem by saying, we're just going to be in the Americas. So, like, we're going to hire people in North and South America, and we're not going to deal with time zones. But you have to anyway, because you have support people, you have SREs and whatnot. And I think I would really encourage companies to take on this problem or take on this opportunity and then use asynchronous as a solution to it, because it's a way that we can really have a tremendous degree of diversity. I mean, we've got people located in Pakistan and Thailand and Australia and Japan and South America and Africa and all over. And so we have a tremendous degree of built-in diversity. And that's something the technology industry really needs. And you cannot reap that benefit of remote work unless you're willing to work with people across time zones. And to us, the answer to that is working asynchronously. So I really advise those techniques for the benefit of working globally. I mean, I think, like, technology, the technology industry, technology salaries, if you look across the world, are on the high side. If we can send that earning power to different people all over the globe, you know, remote work has the potential to lift people out of poverty, to create middle classes in countries that don't have it today. And if we're not taking advantage of that opportunity, I think we're falling short of the promise of remote work. So, like, sometimes, you know, we talk about, like, the potential for, I think Sid, our CEO, calls it the great leveling, which means, like, at some point in the future, you know, the difference in salary between Angola and San Francisco, California in the US, would be the same. And that's going to take a long time to sort of unfold, but that would tell us, you know, there's a tremendous degree of equity kind of across the globe. It'll take time, but you know, certain companies have to innovate and initiate these things. And then you know, we would actually lose an advantage that GitLab has in some way, shape, or form if that would happen, because we do pay local rates, local market rates, and that allows us to have roughly double the number of engineers on our payroll compared to a company that was just based in downtown San Francisco. And so if the great leveling occurred, we would lose that advantage. We'd have the same number of heads on our payroll for the same money, but we would absolutely trade that advantage for the benefits of, you know, like I mentioned, bringing people potentially out of poverty, creating middle classes all over the world. That'd be a, net benefit to humanity. So we would take that in exchange for sure.
And so that's one new, thing. New advantage, right?
Yeah. So that's the first, I'll get off my soapbox, but that's probably the first thing. I think I'll say something that's interesting is like when the pandemic happened and traditional companies were forced to go all remote, we read some articles that said, oh, the sales of so-called spy software, like employee spy software going through the roof, like monitoring what your employees are doing on their home computer. And what that told me is some managers have kind of fallen to the mode of like, well, I'm used to kind of walking the production floor and surveying the corrals of desks. And that's how I develop my sense of whether or not my organization is healthy or productive or these various things. And then when everybody were remote, you lost that tool and there's a sense of anxiety came in. And the instinct was, well, let me replace that with some form of automation that does the exact same thing. GitLab, we know from experience from doing this before the pandemic, during the pandemic, when people are at home, if anything, they tend to work harder. And what we find ourselves doing is actually being very deliberate in coaching people to take vacation. It's okay to take time off. It's okay to, you know, not be there. And so it's almost exactly the opposite instinct that a lot of folks had when the pandemic started that you need to exercise. Because if you don't do that, yeah, people work harder. And you'll see, oh, wow, we're so productive, but obviously that's not sustainable. You'll see attrition and people will be relatively unhappy. And so I encourage people to, encourage your team to take time off. And then also as a leader, try to model the behaviors that you want to see. A lot of people will listen to what you're saying and nod, but really they're thinking like, this isn't true. I can't actually do this. The signal that they will take about what's actually okay to do is by observing what you as a leader do. And so I tell people it's okay to take a vacation. And when I take a vacation, I actually sort of advertise, which I'm not necessarily comfortable doing on its own merits, but I know if that will help other people really understand, yeah, it's okay to take vacation time. We have not just an unlimited vacation time, we have a no ask vacation time policy. And we want people to take it because we know that they're working tremendously hard. So I think people should be aware of that sort of like counter or unintuitive aspect of remote work and just let go of that anxiety of I don't quite know what my people are doing. It's like you'll see if your organization is productive or not based on the results. You don't have to see the works in progress to get that sense.
So two questions. So the first one on productivity of remote work, and I do agree that especially if you have more senior people, this really is the case that you just have more time. In the environment you love and you like working in, if you have the right hardware at home, everything's fine and you're more productive. What about more junior people that potentially are not working for ages? Is that different? How do you solve that challenge?
It is different, yeah. And this is a fantastic question. So when I started at GitLab, we had a level called the junior engineer. And they weren't having a good time. I could see from our people ops metrics, like the attrition rate was an outlier. It was abnormally high for that level. I'm like, something isn't right here. And nobody really had a sense of it. We talked to some external companies, there was a handful of other remote only companies. So we talked to some people from there and they were seeing the same thing. And what that told me is, okay, there's an open unsolved problem here. But if everything I described about remote work being the future of the world and having this great power to improve the human condition, but it doesn't work for young people, that's a big problem. And so, and around that same time, we also shifted into what I would call like hyper growth mode. So I mentioned I was the 100th person in engineering very quickly. This is like calendar year 2018. We got the mandate to grow really fast. So we grew 100% in 2018 and 130% in 2019. And when you're growing that fast, you do need kind of more experienced people. So we took the decision at this point, we have a problem. We don't quite know how to solve it. We also separately have the mandate to grow really fast. We need more experienced people. So we kind of put rules in place that said like roughly about 2 years of professional experience is kind of our bar. But when we did that, and that allowed us to grow really successfully, but we never lost in the back of our heads that we have to come back to this problem and solve it. And when we stopped growing, it becomes hard to grow over 100% when you're already so large. So engineering at that point is like 550 people. It's really hard to grow at 100 or more percent at that point. So when the percent growth slowed, we said, okay, now it's time to come back and really dig our teeth into this problem and figure out what's going on here. So we didn't bring back that old kind of junior engineer hiring process. We brought back what we call engineering internships. And you can Google this. There's a whole process, a set of processes around it. But some of the things we do is we said, you know, okay, teams that are going to seat an intern effectively, they're going to have a manager that's relatively established. They're going to have a team that's sort of at critical mass, and they're not going to be doing a bunch of like other hiring going on. And they're going to have a staff engineer that's ready, you know, a senior individual contributor that's ready to mentor that person to make them successful. So we actually have teams apply to take one of their vacancies and turn it into an internship. And not every team is in a position to do that well. So we reject some teams. And then the key is for us, it's sort of almost like a temporary to permanent arrangement where you do an internship. And our goal is to find people who can reasonably convert into a full-time employee at the end of the internship. And so we got to make sure that that vacancy is open and available. So it's like a team that's ready to hire someone and they're willing to make the investment in an intern and make sure that that seat remains open at the end of the the internship. And we do technical assessments a different way because we're more open to people learning our stack for the first time versus a more experienced engineer that's supposed to be productive in 30 days. And various other things. And we ran our first kind of very deliberate, very careful internship program the summer of 2020, and we were able to convert 75% of those people to full time. And so we actually exceeded our goals preventing that attrition and that conversion rate. And so that was great. And the crazy thing about that is that when we designed the program, it was before the pandemic. So we thought we need to do an in-person kickoff. So we're going to fly everybody to the Netherlands, where we have a bunch of GitLabbers, do a week of sort of onboarding and hackathons and whatnot. People go back to wherever they were from, do their 3 or 4 month internship, and then bring them to San Francisco and do sort of like an end of internship party and same thing. And then the pandemic hit and we couldn't do those in-person things. And then it turns out it wasn't necessary. And so the other things we had developed actually allowed us to make young people successful without relying on any degree of in-person interaction. And it worked impressively well. I'm happy to report there is not a limitation about remote work for young people. Or we didn't limit it to just young people. It's not a university internship program. We said anyone who's coming new to their first technology job. Yes, it does end up being a proportion of university students, but it also might be someone who is an engineer in the energy sector. Maybe they're working on a coal mine or something like that, and they want to leave that industry and join software, or that could be an engineering internship as well. And so we've proven that remote work can make people new to the technology field for a variety of reasons successful in their first job. And so I would just advise that remote leaders out there, just be very deliberate about that sort of thing. Because I think back to when I was new to the field and I described coming in with, you know, without the traditional computer science education and not knowing what a startup was or what equity or any of that stuff was. And I was successful in part because I was sitting next to a couple of people in an on-premise office and I just peppered them with questions all day long. Because I had a tremendous amount I needed to learn, not just about the skills of programming to be successful, but also how to operate in a professional environment, how customer and vendor relationships work and all those sorts of things. And so you're doing a tremendous degree of learning in your first technology job, and you need asynchronous and remote ways to sort of push through that learning to be successful. And you have to support that. So you have to be very deliberate.
Okay. And then second question, you mentioned that you encourage people to take vacations and take days off. Do you have something like a minimum amount of days off or?
We do have some guidelines. I forget exactly what it is, but it's like 3 weeks of vacation a year or something like that. But really we, you know, sometimes when people need a day, whether it's like a mental health sort of day or during the pandemic, people have had to, maybe they're caring for relatives who are sick or going to doctor's appointments or whatnot. It might be like in the moment as opposed to like, oh, I've got a vacation 3 months from now. And so we really encourage people to take what they need, when they need it. And sometimes it's just as simple as like, you know, take a couple hours off and go for a walk and get some sunshine and get your blood moving. Cause you're getting a little bit burned out. as opposed to, you know, a matter of weeks of vacation time or something like that. And that's maybe another lesson for remote managers is, you know, the signs of burnout are harder to see when people are remote. When you're in person at the office, you see someone showing up to the stand up 5 minutes late, or you see them kind of dragging around the office or something like that. And you don't have as much synchronous in-person time with people. You don't get to read their body language. So you just, again, have to be deliberate, you know, in one-on-ones, just be asking people the question, you know, don't underestimate the power of just asking people like, hey, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Do you feel like you're getting burned out? And then if they are, you know, working through that with them. We coach our people. We say in our handbook, like, try to be a manager of one. Like, you know, you are the shepherd of your own time. You know, manage it well. And that's part of being successful. And that's part of operating in a professional environment is not burning yourself out. And so we try to do our best to care for people and also remind them that, like, hey, there is an element of personal responsibility. You have to manage your own self. And if you need help, you know, raise your hand. And there's a variety of resources available for people to do that.
Okay, thanks a lot. So one thing I still wanted to touch is the fact of actually hiring people. So, I mean, you mentioned that you hire people on local rates. And I guess you use like the normal channels like Stack Overflow and others. Is there some secret sauce in actually proposing the right salary? Are there databases? Is there something you use to calculate the cost of living factor or anything you want to?
Yeah. At most companies our scale, 1,500 people, you probably have a compensation focused team. I would say we had to bring that online much earlier in our company's life cycle than you otherwise would. I think most 200 person startups have one person fully dedicated to compensation, but there's a lot of complexity to understanding what the market is globally. And so we needed people to specialize that earlier in our company's life than most other companies. So that's one lesson. Like, you should have compensation specialists if you're going to do the fully global thing. In terms of what to sort of gear off of, like, you probably have some form of formula where you understand the different rates for different roles, then the local market is the input to that. You can use cost of living. From what I understand at GitLab, that was looked at early on. It was determined to be too difficult. They did use something called rent index, which as a proxy for that, because, you know, most of your money goes towards where you live. What we found is that didn't do a great job covering specific markets. Like, I think the secret is out at this point about Berlin, but 3 years ago, Berlin used to be a place with pretty economical rents for a major city, but very high tech salaries. And so rent index there was not a great proxy for how engineers were being paid. Now I think that's sort of corrected itself. I hear that rents in Berlin have gone up quite a bit over the last few years, but Austin, Texas, Berlin, other areas, it made it difficult to hire there because it was not a good proxy. So what we say now is that we don't pay cost of living, we don't pay rent index, we pay market rate. And there's a variety of inputs to what the market rate is. But we look at other salaries, other companies out there. We do pay, there's various companies that maintain their own databases and sell that data to various companies. We use those as well. And we try to integrate them together to develop our sense of what the local market rate is. And that way you're covered. If there is a place that has, it's usually an outlier, but if some place has very low cost of living or very low housing prices, but a huge tech market with high salaries, you want to make sure you can be effective recruiting there. And if you're just gearing off one of those elements, you're going to miss and be ineffective hiring there. And then there's the opposite could happen. Sometimes you end up accidentally really overpaying a region. Usually we say like, yeah, we're okay with that, because usually when that happens, those are areas that are sort of low from a dollar amount anyway. And it's an area where, you know, as I mentioned, like the technology industry is trying to expand and try to get to those areas anyway. So it helps that positive differential of the team member usually helps that sort of grade leveling get a little bit closer. So we're much less strict when those sorts of things happening than the opposite.
Okay. Yeah, cool. I think there should be like an open salary database, right? For engineering, that would be quite helpful.
We'd love it. We had our information public for a time, but that prevented us from using external databases and whatnot, because that's other people's information, and we couldn't give that away for free. So someone should take that on, but and we'd be happy to benefit from it. But it is dynamic. I mean, it's not like you create it once and everybody gets to use it forever. It's it changes several times a year substantively. So it would be a big commitment for someone to maintain that and be giving it away for free.
Okay, so one more topic to cover is, I think, the fact of giving feedback to each other. I think that's also something which is quite different in remote companies. How do you do that? Do you have like processes on that, or?
I say again, sorry.
Giving feedback, like giving others feedback. Is there like a structured feedback process in your world, or?
I don't think it's highly structured. We do have guidelines in our like, when I think of highly structured, I think almost like a note going into your file, and so it's not like that. We do have a bunch of processes and recommendations for managers and how they run one-on-ones, and we do want them giving feedback. We want them being kind as they deliver feedback. It should be kind. It should be constructive. It should be written down so it's clear. People should have time to ask questions about it. Sometimes it can be difficult to receive feedback, so people sometimes need time to process it, and maybe you talk about feedback and then you address it the next day or the next one-on-one or something like that. That's okay too. We do say feedback should be, you know, one-on-one. It may be true, but if you're giving someone feedback amongst other people, I think you can unnecessarily trigger their sort of sense of shame or something like that. And then I think you've lost the opportunity to make that a teaching moment. So we try to encourage people to do that in sort of a closed setting, or it's a safe space, and then and make that between manager and managee, and also peer to peer to the extent it's appropriate.
So quite normal, no McKinsey process that I don't know encourages everyone to give at least 5 feedbacks to others every quarter or something like that, right?
No, we don't have anything like that, and I would worry that you're not getting the quality from that. If it's forced, if it's too prescribed, I would question about whether or not people are just sort of, you know, coming up with you know, I have to give 5, I have one thing, so I'm going to come up with another 4. You know, I would worry about that aspect, but it'd be interesting to see how that worked.
Okay, looking a bit more into the future. So, what do you think how remote working and hiring remote engineers will look like in 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it's you know, remote work, the technology industry in general, can deliver on what I described, and it's truly global. I mean, I'd love to see you know, more tech companies, more tech employees in Africa and Asia and these other areas. Where the relatively high salaries or industry pays can be benefit not just those individuals, but it lifts the community up, I think. And so I hope that more companies kind of take on this very global, diverse approach, and we can deliver on some of those promises.
Looking forward to see that, yeah. So I still have a little surprise for you, Eric. I actually discovered a hidden repository in your GitLab profile. It is actually from your early days at Brightcuf, a company that produces video streaming software you've worked for before. And it is a video player that contains real-time recording of your life. And now we have the chance to skip back in time, watch the video of your life and time lapse through GitLab, Airware, the Linux Foundation, and everything you went through. And we're now seeing you working at Brightcuff, and we can now hit pause. And now we see you sitting there coding in a quiet room, and now you have the chance to whisper something into young Eric's ears. What would it be?
Yeah, great question. Gosh, I mean, part of, you know, Everything I experienced, good and bad, was part of what kind of led me to where I am today. So for the most part, I tend not to have regrets. I certainly go back and think, oh, well, I could have done that a lot better. But I'm at peace with the fact I learned from those experiences. But I think the most remarkable experiences or learnings for me was that might be good for Noah's, for younger me to know is I now have three kids. So I got married. I'm celebrating my 9-year wedding anniversary tomorrow, actually, with my wife. We've got three little girls, age 1, 4, and 6. And I feel like I got a relatively late start on that. And to some extent, I may have been kind of hesitant and think, oh, it's going to take away from my time at work or my personal time, whatever. And now having gone through it, I realized like, gosh, I'm actually so much more effective at work for the time that I have to take out of the day to spend with my family and to care for small children. And that's so counterintuitive. I never would have guessed that that was the case. And what I realized is in those days, you know, I had the flexibility to pull an all-nighter or work around the clock or whatever it was. And I felt that I was delivering more results and I probably felt I was efficient at the time. But what I know now is I was probably ruthlessly inefficient. I could do net more just because I was putting, I got diminishing returns for that extra time I was putting in. And having kids, it really forced me to ruthlessly prioritize my time. So now I have my working hours and, I know that I need to get the most out of those working hours because when you're interacting with small kids, like there's no negotiation. If they want to play or if they need something, you have to do that thing. And for the focus that I now have on my work time, I'm so much more effective. And I imagine, I hope I'll retain that after the kids are older and become more independent. And it just shows me like, yeah, if I could tell myself that, that fact, I probably could have figured it out earlier and that I was past that point of diminishing returns without necessarily knowing it. And, you always have those experiences of like you're coding and all of a sudden it's 1 a.m. and you're like, oh, I should refactor this. And then you go another 4 or 5 hours and you wake up the next day and read the code. It's like, who wrote this? What was I thinking? Those are the types of things when you push yourself too hard. And it's actually net positive to constrain yourself and try to get the most out of that time. And you like say like, great art comes from constraints, like Shakespeare writing an iambic pentameter, writing those sonnets. It's a very formal structure. And yet that's part of where the sort of beauty of the art comes from. I think that's true for work and for coding and engineering and whatnot. So I would say welcome those constraints, try to work within them and you would find your way to be more effective.
Yeah, having kids is like jumping in ice water first, right?
Yeah. The first one especially is eye-opening the way it affects your life. But it's also a one-way door. You can't imagine what it's going to be like with kids and you walk through that door and you can't ever imagine the world where they don't exist. It's a remarkable experience, but a positive one even for work.
Yeah, I still had that moment on weekends when I had like one hour in the middle of the day where my daughter was sleeping and I could still do something. But then at a certain time, it also disappeared. and then you just realize, okay, yeah, I have to live with it. And it's okay. I can work at other times. It's just fine, right?
And it's hard to, if you want to get hands-on technical, it's hard to do anything in an hour, especially if you've been away from technology for a while and you have to go back and set up your local environment or whatnot. You probably get halfway through that and then your hour's gone. And so you do need those 4 or 8 hour stretches to get really, really hands-on. But, it's been a really positive experience. And so, if you're about to have a kid, just know, it's difficult, but it's certainly a very positive experience. And if you're hesitant about it, as I was in my young days, I would say don't be afraid. You'll survive.
And you obviously did. And
we also young. I can't say out of the woods yet.
We also survived this podcast, and it was a very positive experience for me. So thanks a lot, Eric. For being my guest, and I hope we can repeat it at a certain time. Maybe we meet in person at a certain time. Let's see. Whenever traveling is allowed again. So looking forward to meet you again, Eric. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Cheers.